always time to go exploring. Welcome to Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jade Quinn McDonald. This episode was recorded on the unceded territory of the Muchalat, Mauchat, Lakwitat, and Comox people, and we are recording through the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, Coast Salish, and Squamish territories. Today, we are going to chat with a friend of mine named Jamie Sharp, a paddler extraordinaire who just happened to be recertifying his wilderness first aid here at Strathcona Park Lodge, where I'm working for the summer. We are sitting in his F-350, and it's very warm, and we are on the side of Highway 28, so don't mind the intermittent truck whooshing. Welcome, Jamie.
Thank you.
So, I named your name, but who are you? Where are you from? What do you do?
I'm originally from New Zealand, though I've kind of, in the last 21 years or so, I've been living all over the world, though primarily based out of British Columbia here. And I currently run a sea kayaking business, but I've also throughout my life been just a contract guide doing multiple different jobs, and still do run a opposing aspect of guiding where I work in the Arctic as a polar bear guide, photography guide.
So we just got off the water here on Upper Campbell Lake, and I was admiring your beautiful paddles. How long have you paddled for leisure, whether it be canoe or kayak or sail? I suppose it's not paddling, but boating.
It's water sports, mm-hmm. Yeah. I got into paddle sports essentially when I was, I guess I was 11 years old or 12 years old, and my uncle in New Zealand organized a canoeing trip down the Whanganui River in New Zealand. It was a 8-day trip. It's mostly a flat water trip, but there was some white water in it. And at the time, we had an odd number of people, so we were in what they call in New Zealand Canadian canoes. Mm-hmm. whereas here in Canada, they're just canoes.
Yep.
So tripping canoes.
Figure.
Yeah. And we had one, it was my cousin, who's my older cousin. He was in an old Dancer white water kayak. And nobody in that group knew how to kayak, or more to the point, knew how to roll a kayak. Mm-hmm. And so there was a bunch of swimming that occurred. Though at the same time, there was swimming occurring with the canoes. And I remember as a kid being really annoyed, being at the mercy of my mother, who was the sterns person in our canoe, or whoever else I was in there with, and being going, man, I just want to be able to do this by myself and be responsible for my own lines. And obviously looking at my cousin in the Dancer, who was also swimming but only had himself to blame, mm-hmm. I was like, I want to learn to kayak. And the following year, my uncle signed up for the local kayak club, and I started going along with him. And to his annoyance, I learned to roll a kayak within 3 sessions.
Oh, there we go.
And I was addicted at that point. Then I was like, this is what I want to do. So I kept at it. I, within a year, was paddling Class 3 rivers.
Not
and...
bad.
Got invited by some other young guys that were in the club to join their kayak polo or canoe polo team.
Nice.
And so for all of my high school years, I played competitive canoe polo.
No way.
And was part of the national development team for New Zealand. And that was like a really great skill developing sport to play. So the only thing that would be better for whitewater paddling to develop skill would be in slalom, mm-hmm. whitewater slalom. So that was a really awesome place to be. So I was paddling whitewater fun. I was paddling canoe polo for sport. I also did martial arts at the time as my other sort of passion.
Mm-hmm.
And whitewater became kind of like my fixation. And that was kind of the beginning.
Mm-hmm. The bud.
The bud, yeah. And then what kind of happened when I was 16, almost 17, I had a car crash and had both of my ankles dislocated and luckily kept my legs. But that meant that martial arts was now off the table. Mm-hmm. And so what became really logical was that I just shoved my legs in a kayak and I paddled.
Of course.
And so then paddling became my one and only for a large aspect of my life. Yeah, so then I, for a long time, just wanted to be a whitewater kayak instructor.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously had the romantic idea of like, yeah, I want to live the extreme life of paddling awesome rivers. And I ended up working at on our school camp in my senior years at high school and met a young lady working at the school camp who was an outdoor instructor, and she taught whitewater. And I was like, how did you get into this? And she's like, oh, I went to university and I studied outdoor education and recreation. And so I was like, oh, I want to do that. And, you know, up to this point, I was also right into photography, wanted to be a biologist and a photographer. And for the prime reason, I just wanted to be outside and I wanted to be around wild animals and I wanted to be in nature. And a lot of people who were biologists talked to me and said, well, why do you want to do it? And I said, well, just because I want to be out there and I want to see these things and I want to travel the world. And they were like, well, you know, there's lots of other ways to do it. Biology isn't necessarily the best way to do it. You might end up working in, you know, becoming a scholar and becoming a, you know, a professor at a college. And, you know, it's not necessarily all field work. And so with my love of outdoor pursuits and nature and photography, I just sort of got into, you know, I just went, well, I'm going to apply for this outdoor education, you know.
At what school?
This was at Auckland University of Technology in New Zealand.
Nice.
It's a two-year associate's degree, I guess diploma we call it in New Zealand. And then it led on to, if I wanted to, another year and a half, and I could do a bachelor's in sport and recreation.
Mm-hmm. Song break. Let's take a listen to Off He Goes by Pearl Jam. This was written by vocalist Eddie Vedder and was released in January of 1997 as the third single from the band's fourth studio album, No Code. Apparently the song peaked at number 31 on the Billboard Alternative Song charts. The story of Off He Goes concerns a friend who periodically comes whirling in and out of the protagonist's life. And in an interview, Vedder revealed himself to be that friend. Jamie has a very fluid lifestyle and he works seasonally. He said he sees himself coming in and out of people's lives as well. So this one's for you.
Same old Tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
Got one more quick PSA before we head back to the interview. This comes from a Canadian band, up-and-coming Frank Mona.
Frank freaking Mona. We're back. We're here. We just played the Mac and Tofino. It was a great show, great turnout, lots of millennials. My name is Peyton, I play the drums.
My name is Ben, and I play bass.
I'm Nico, guitar.
I'm Dominic Wong. I'm the lead singer of Frank Mona.
You could find us anywhere you listen to music for cool alternative rock and indie music.
Check us out on Instagram, Facebook,
Twitter,
Tidal,
Snapchat.
And together we're Bumble. Frank Mona.
Check us out on Tidal.
Yes.
Peace.
Welcome back. You're listening to Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jade Quinn McDonald. This is CITR 101.9 FM. We're getting back to our chat with sponsored kayaker Jamie Sharp. He's going to tell us more about why he's truly dedicated to this sport and what kind of adventures he's gotten up to around the world.
Those sort of three things, paddle, marine sailing, and navigation, backpacking, camping out multiple days, essentially you put those together and that becomes sea kayaking. Mm-hmm. And I never really gave sea kayaking much respect. You know, it was always something old guys did with big long grey beards. Ironically, I am now 42 and I have a grey beard. So I was always kind of like, oh, sea kayaking, that's just for old guys. And then I ended up injuring myself. So I was actually on a backpacking trip and I took off my backpack and I wasn't paying attention. I let the backpack slide off my back and the weight of the pack actually pulled both of my shoulders out of their joints. And so they both subluxed, or they, you know, semi-dislocated. They popped out and they went back in again. And being young and dumb, I was going like, oh, whatever, they work again. I'll just keep hiking, which was fine. But then at the time, I was working on school camps, and I was doing rappelling instruction. So I was taking kids, and we were rappelling off 150-foot waterfalls and stuff. Wow. And I was hauling ropes. And
was that the canyoning?
It was just a rappelling, really. We get to this top, but there's a point you can anchor, and you can send them off this cool rappel down a waterfall. And it was, but then you'd have to haul this rope up at the end of the day. And so I was doing that every day, and I was being right-handed. I was favoring that side, injured shoulder. That led to a muscle imbalance to protect that injured shoulder, which then ultimately froze my shoulder. So then my right arm didn't work properly, and then I had to stop paddling. And then the story goes on and on. But what we also did was we then did a big challenging sea kayaking trip as the last thing we did at university. And so we did this big log sea kayaking trip, and I towed one of the ladies on my course for the last 4 hours of a day because she was even slow, and I towed her and I kind of gave it all. And by the next morning, my shoulder was really not happy. And that was kind of it. My shoulder from that point on was kind of screwed and frozen up. So then I stopped paddling, went into outdoor retail, worked for outdoor retail for 6 months and rehabbed my shoulder during that time. And then took a job as a sea kayak guide in the southern part of New Zealand as a way to rehab my shoulder back into paddling, because a lot of the injury was caused by a muscle imbalance from a lot of whitewater paddling, aggravated by dislocation, aggravated by what I did as a job. So sea kayaking was a great controlled medium to start paddling and getting my technique back. What I didn't expect to find was like the ultimate combination of all the things I loved and a great way to make a living and travel the world.
Because sea kayaking is no joke, really.
No, it isn't.
You can kind of take it as far as you want to in terms of complexity of water.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. And so I now, for the last 10 years almost, have been sponsored for sea kayaking, not just because of, you know, paddling flat water and having a grey beard, at the time and still to this day, mostly because I've combined or followed the trend of combining white water and sea kayaking and doing what we now call white water of the sea or rough water sea kayaking, where you surf sea kayaks, you do big rock gardening, which is essentially whitewater rapids, that where the ocean surges and flows over rocks on the coast and you ride it over and through in channels, and sort of pushing the limit of what sea kayaks have been regarded to be able to do, including surfing large standing waves that used to be considered just the realm of Ben Maher and his playboats. And
I agree,
I've been on the wave with Ben, and he still throws way sicker moves than I can in a sea kayak. But the beauty of surfing a huge wave with a big, long boat is also a really amazing thing to do. And so that combination of still bringing in the white water into the realm of sea kayaking, and then also being able to combine ultra long distance expeditions and then being able to make a living from it, running sea kayaking tours and now having an actual sea kayaking tour business, has been a really amazing avenue. And you know, something I also say is, you know, it's really hard to be sponsored as a whitewater paddler, and you've got to paddle some pretty extreme shit. As a sea kayak paddler, you can paddle some pretty gnarly stuff and do things, and you can get sponsorship a little bit easier. And then, so for me, it was like a great way for me to make money, paddle, keep my paddling fitness, and then on my own, I could still pursue whitewater as my personal thing. And so that was, and still is, a really nice balance in my life, whereas I'm not working my ass off on a river, making whatever money as a raft guide. I actually can make a living wage as a sea kayak guide, and now running my own business, make a decent amount of money. Whereas in my experience in the past as a raft guide, working in New Zealand and raft guides and other places, I wasn't making really that much money.
Go figure.
And yeah, and
raft
plus
guiding doesn't pay well.
Yeah.
You kidding?
And it's high risk.
Yeah.
So so before this injury happened, I was working as a whitewater kayak instructor, and realized, oh, whitewater kayak constructing is actually quite boring, because you're actually paddling on flat water most of the time, teaching people the concepts. Eventually you get them on a class one river and you're doing a bunch of little eddy turns, and then you do it all over again. And I was kind of like, this is mind numbing. Then I got into raft guiding. My very first day when I started raft guiding, the guy I was living with had one of his clients die on the river the day before.
Oh my God.
So my first introduction to raft guiding was the worst case scenario of someone's just had a client die on the river. And so I was introduced to that straight away and all this. But then also working on a very commercial river where it was the highest rafted waterfall in the southern hemisphere, and a lot of things can gonna go wrong. So
do you
can
know how many meters it was?
What is it? It's like a 9 meter waterfall.
Wow. That's
and,
big.
So it's, yeah, you get your raft, you know, a proper, just a paddle raft, not an oar raft, but it's, you get it completely vertical.
Yeah.
and it's 50-50 whether it stays upright or not, which is part of the fun. But it's amazing how much people don't listen, or people don't do this, and how many people come up with injuries. And it's just a, you know, it's kind of a high stress game.
Yeah.
And then you're taking people down class four or five rivers that they shouldn't be swimming, and potentially they fall out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, I think I still love rafting, and I still think it's, you know, really a lot of fun. But as for me personally, and the job was quite stressful for kind of an odd amount of money. And so when I got injured and got into sea kayaking, I was like, holy cow, this is like, I get to eat good food. Mm-hmm. I get to take people actually on a journey, which was the main thing I liked, because
mm-hmm.
I wasn't really into instructing that much myself. I was like, I just want to go on a journey, and I want to take people on a journey. And New Zealand didn't have a big industry for multi-day trips so much. It was right. more about half days, day trips, quarter day trips. So it really wasn't until I worked sea kite guiding that I was like, oh, I did like my first sort of like 3-day commercial trip, and I was like, this is awesome. And then what happened is I ended up coming to Canada on a working holiday visa.
Right, I was going to ask.
Yeah.
How'd you end up over here?
Is that first truck going by?
That was a big rig.
Yeah, so I ended up applying for a working holiday visa, and like, there's a kind of a story to that too. Like, my father's South African, and I actually had plans of going to Southern Africa and becoming a park ranger and working in the industry there. But I was initially going to do that with my dad, and he was going to come, well, at least travel with him to start with. And but then we had some issues where he couldn't travel. And so I was like, well, while you're dealing out your finances, I'm going to go to Canada and work there, because I had just been leading a trip in the Abel Tasman in New Zealand sea kayaking, and we had these killer whales swim into a bay. And then we were having lunch, and I was like, yeah, everyone get in your boats. And we jumped in there, and we paddled out into the bay, and we paddled with the orcas, and they swam by. And then we kind of paddled out, and we would have liked to have kind of hung around near them a little bit more, but once we were out of the bay, the wind was too strong, and we couldn't paddle into it. But that just got me. I was just like, this is amazing. And then I spoke to this Canadian guy who was working as a kayak guide in the Abel Tasman at the time. And he was like, oh, if you think that's cool, you should come and work in British Columbia, because there's a huge amount of resident orca that live up here. And in the summer, you can almost paddle with them every day. And that just blew my mind. I'm like, really? Okay, I've got to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just amazing. So came to Canada with the idea of working with killer whales, sea kite guide in the summer, and then I really wanted to learn a dog sled guide, because I'd read, you know, Jack London's Call of the Wild and, you know, White Fang and all these things, and I was just like, I want to learn that aspect. And so, yeah, that's what I did. I worked on the island here for a summer, sea kite guiding, which introduced me to, like, proper 7-day to 12-day expedition trips, and I was like, oh, this is my calling.
Yeah.
This is really what it's about for me, is I want to go on big trips and take people and get paid for it. Like, this is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I realized this is what I want to do with my life.
Yeah, big trip. Jamie and I went on a bigger trip last summer down the Tatshenshini and Alsek rivers.
Yeah.
But that was more of a respite for you, right, from work?
Yeah, well, people always wonder, like, oh, you do this for a living and you still want to go on trips when you're off. And I'm like, well, yeah, I personally would just live in a tent my entire life, really. Like, I just like going on journeys, and it's really, for me, it's, I don't know, it's just this amazing, healthy addiction in a way. It's, I like the simplicity of it. I like the joy of it. I love the amazing things you see every day.
Yeah. It sounds like you've kind of followed a path of large wildlife.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kind of, I think it's always been my drawer was
introduced you to the, like, the Pacific coast here.
Yeah.
And then,
well, I think initially my love of, as a kid, reading books, Nat Geo books and stuff like that, and just charismatic megafauna and just anything quirky. I always really didn't like living in New Zealand because I found it so boring, because there was nothing dangerous. I always wanted to live in Australia where the snakes were and the spiders were. I always wanted to live in Africa where the lions were and stuff, because I was like, that stuff's really interesting. Yeah. New Zealand's just got a bunch of flightless birds, and probably the scariest thing you find in the woods is a wild pig. And
which are scary.
They are, but they're not like, you know, they're not like bumping into a cougar or a grizzly bear.
Yeah.
And those things always drew me.
Mm-hmm.
So that led to me having a sort of fascination with the outdoors, which led to me becoming a guide, and then killer whales led me to coming to Canada, and then eventually I actually ended up going to Africa, and for a while with a business partner we ran overland safari trips in Namibia, and so that was a little bit of a fun little segue in life until some things.
When was that?
When was that? That would have been like 2012 to 2014, something like that.
2 full years or seasons?
Seasons. So we just went there for parts of the year. We had plans of it getting busier, but it was just, it wasn't, we didn't make good choices as a business. And then also just some things happened in her life with her family that it just became complicated. And then I was being drawn in other directions at that point. I had started getting involved in media creation for outdoor companies. I was working with development of some sea kayak designs and creating film projects for them. And so I found myself being paid to sort of travel and paddle. So at that point, it was really the opening point of becoming a paid athlete / sponsored paddler. And, you know, prior to that, I'd already been working for numerous years in Central America, working on rivers and sea kayaking on the coast. And I started working in Costa Rica a bit, Belize a lot. I only made it halfway. It was still over 2,000 kilometers paddled. And got smashed up on the beaches a number of times by tropical cyclones. I ended up getting bitten by the only poisonous animal there is in New Zealand, which is a spider. Got put in hospital.
Oh, my God.
My paddling partner, Dave, he ended up getting blitzed on another beach shortly after that. And then
what
he was like...
What does blitzed mean?
Basically, his boat got broken up. He ended up swimming with a broken boat onto a beach. And then we fixed it, paddled off. And he was like, yeah, I'm done. And then I paddled the last 3 weeks by myself down the coast to finish. And managed to pull into the capital city of Wellington. Literally a... Well, probably not even a day, like literally 8 hours before the next cyclone hit and shut us down or shut me down for another week. And then I didn't choose to continue because it was getting too close to winter. And if I had crossed the strait to the Southern Island at that point, I probably would have only been able to paddle another 3 to 4 weeks before I would have had to have come back. And so I just called her that. And then that really just opened up some things. And I made some calls and started working for another company called Track Kayaks and helped, you know, help promote their folding kayak business. And I traveled all over the world creating a small video series called The Track Files, which is all about how their folding boat is actually a really good product and you can travel the world and do crazy things with it. And that led to me being a sponsored ambassador for Kokodat, but then also led to me working in Norway for a bit and discovering the Svalbard archipelago and realizing that no one had successfully paddled around this archipelago before. And up to this point, I'd been searching for something that was a real challenge, and New Zealand was kind of like the training ground of like, okay, I'm going to sort my shit out, figure out how I'm going to do this, and then find something really, really worthy. And Svalbard came along and found out there'd been at least 2 attempts before that had failed, and I was like, let's give this a go.
And how big is this trip in kilometers? Like, how long?
So basically, in the end, we ended up paddling 2,300 kilometers.
That's hard to fathom.
Yeah.
Really.
And it was a 72-day trip of paddling in the Arctic with frozen ocean part of it, lots of polar bears, lots of walrus. And so this trip was a trip that was like, this is awesome to do. Being attempted twice, one trip failed because a guy fell through the ice and was semi-paralyzed and had to get airlifted. The next trip that happened, a polar bear came through their campsite, grabbed one of the guys by the head, dragged him out of the tent, almost killed him. His expedition buddy was able to shoot past him, hit the bear. They killed the bear. No one died except for the bear, unfortunately. And that was their trip over. And so everyone's like, well, now you don't really want to do this, right? Because the second one happened while I was planning to do it, and then suddenly these guys are doing it. I'm like, ooh, will they make it? And so everyone's like, you don't want to do this now. Those guys almost died. And I'm like, well, actually, I'm more interested in it because now it's not just about a physical feat of strength of who can you paddle long enough. It's about can you actually work with nature and not kill an animal or be killed by the animal. Mm-hmm. And so that was basically in 2010. So it was actually just before I did the New Zealand trip. I'd been in Norway and I'd sort of got an idea for Svalbard. And then we ended up talking about doing it in 2013, but it never happened. And it wasn't until 2015, so almost 5 years later, that we ended up doing it. And I found a team to do it with me. Per Gustav from Norway and Tara Mulvani, who was also a New Zealander.
How did you find them?
Per Gustav, or PG, I worked with his wife when I was in Norway. So he was the first guy I told about it, and he was like, oh, I'll do that trip with you. And he's ex-Special Forces from Norway, and he's skied across Norway by himself, and he was raised in the north, and so he was very comfortable with the Arctic and very comfortable with guns and very comfortable with his own ability, but he also wasn't a very experienced paddler. But I wasn't overly worried about that because he was physically capable enough that he would adapt. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't meet Tara until probably end of 2013. And then she ended up coming to Canada and she paddled around Vancouver Island, and then we did some whitewater trips together, and then ended up traveling down the coast of America on a road trip I was doing for work and paddling rivers and stuff. And then I was like, hey, would you be into paddling Svalbard? And she was going, yeah, I'd do that. And then I told her about the polar bears. Mm-hmm. And then she was like, oh, well. And then she still was like, okay, I'd still do it. And so she had already done some major trips. So she had already paddled around every island of New Zealand, or the three main islands, so the North, the South, and Stewart Island. Mm-hmm. And so she'd done that and basically become the third person, I think, at the time, or maybe even the second person at the time, to do all three islands, and was definitely the first woman at the time to have done all three islands. And that's no small feat. Like, I only did half of one island, and that was like an intense trip, and so she's done all the coasts.
Wow.
And so I knew that she was tough enough to do it. Yeah, so we pulled it together and required applying for permits and getting enough money and all sorts of stuff, and we managed to pull that together. And off we went, and that's a whole another podcast to talk about. Mm-hmm. That trip. It's the most epic trip I've ever done. I don't think I'll ever do another trip that was that crazy. Or, basically, I'd never experienced the high Arctic before, and so to experience it for the very first time via a kayak trip was a very intimate and intense way to do it.
And what exactly does high Arctic mean? Is that just like a general term for above the Arctic Circle?
No, so there's you've got subarctic, which is essentially below the Arctic Circle, just below. Then you've got the Arctic, which is essentially the Arctic Circle and above. And then high Arctic is essentially when you're in the last sort of 10 degrees before you, or 10, I guess, yeah, probably more like 15 to 18 mm-hmm. degrees before you get to the north. And so you're in that really high upper region where there's a very short window of weather where you can do trips, really, and the ice freezes up. The landscape doesn't have trees at all. It's very barren, and you're very much in the realm of the polar bear at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, and walrus. Like, walrus are very stressful creatures to be around too, especially when you're in kayaks. And yeah, so that was a trip that we did, and people supported us to do it, and we actually did succeed, and we became the first sea kayakers to get around all three islands.
Oh my god.
And then came back to discover that all these people that had supported us were like, yeah, but we never actually thought you would do it. We were like, okay, have fun, you're probably not going to make this, but you can do it. And even the government had at that point decided that they probably weren't going to give permits out, and they got our application, and they decided that they would give us the last permit chance.
Wow.
And because our plan was solid and we seemed to be quite solid as individuals with our experience, that they were like, okay, we'll give these guys the last go at it.
That's quite incredible.
And they were impressed too, and they said, oh shit, these guys are actually going to make it round. And when we talked to them at the end of it, they're like, yeah, we weren't sure. And then you did it, and now we're interested to see if more people apply to do it, or less people apply to do it. But then what I've heard has happened since is they've discontinued it. They said no, they don't give out permits to people wanting to do those big extended wow. trips anymore. So yeah, we were the first to have done it,
and
we may only maybe. Yeah may not be any other attempts.
Wow. So that thrust you into the Arctic, I suppose.
Yeah, so I had worked in the lower Arctic prior to that, and a bit of the upper Arctic in the summer, but not in, you know, I'd worked around polar bears a bit in Churchill, Manitoba.
Mm-hmm.
But after this trip, people were like, oh, you have lived and experienced polar bears. So like, to give you an idea, we were chased by polar bears in the water in our kayaks. I woke up with a polar bear on top of the tent one morning.
Oh my God.
We had a standoff with a big male polar bear for over 9 minutes where we shot multiple rounds of bangers and bullets and bounced them off the ground and in the air, and eventually he walked away. We thought we were possibly going to have to shoot him to defend ourselves, but luckily we didn't. We had, including those encounters we just talked about, there was 20 what we would consider like aggressive or active encounters where bears were coming at us and we had to either move away or we had to repel them with defensive mechanisms.
Right.
And we were very vulnerable the whole time, just living in a tent with a tripwire system around us and one of us being awake at all times.
Oh gosh.
So we're on a military watch where for 2 hours someone would be awake and then they'd switch out with the next person and you just keep rotating through.
That's intense.
Yeah, so it's a very intense way of living and it was a very intense trip, but it was like the most amazing, surreal trip. And very much type 3 fun in a lot of it.
Yeah. Type 3.
Yeah. You heard of type 3 fun?
What's type 3?
Well, it's like three types of fun. Actually, some would argue there's four.
Uh-huh.
So type 1 is like literally you're having fun. So you're at a party, you're dancing, you're laughing, you're smiling, you're having fun right there. Type 2 fun is like, oh, you're having fun, but you don't really necessarily know it.
Mm-hmm.
Until after it, and you're like, yeah, that was kind of fun, and I'll, you know, I'd do that again. I didn't really quite know I was having fun at the time, mm-hmm. but I was also enjoying it. Type 3 is kind of like, this is traumatic, and I don't know whether I would ever do this again, but then 2 years later, you're like, you know what, that was probably one of the coolest things I ever did.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Yeah, that's definitely thrown around in the outdoor world, the types of fun.
Yeah.
Struggle fests, suffer fests.
Yeah. Often it's type 1, type 2, but mm-hmm. then, you know, there's that type 3 where mm-hmm. it's like literally, you know, I think Tara particularly, it was almost 3 years before I got a message from her saying, you know what, that was one of the best trips I've ever done. Thank you for having it on air. And that to me is type 3 fun. You know, it takes 3 years for you to go, that was fun.
You know what, I guess that wasn't horrible.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Song break. This one is Ramble On by Led Zeppelin. Jamie says the tales in this song paint a picture of his life's flow. This one is rocky and energizing, but still talking about the pain of an individual seeking something beyond what ordinary life is offering. Enjoy.
Sometimes
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek coffee today.
Okay, let's see here. Blend equal parts science and stories. Add a few shakes of music and soundscape, and wrap it all up in a big question. How can we see this more than human world in a new light and take part in shaping a healthy Anthropocene? Catch Future Ecologies every Sunday at 8 a.m. on CITR.
Welcome back to Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jade Quinn McDonald. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We're about to come to a close here with Jamie's statements on how he recommends you get into the guiding world.
So evidently you have a lot of background experience and base knowledge that then helped you progress in the guiding world. Is that something you would generally advise to people as a way to get into the guiding industry, just like experience?
Yes and no. Like, at university, studying the scholarly aspects of the outdoor recreation and instruction industry, there was always a thing of like, well, there's two avenues, right? There's obviously you go out and get the experience, mm-hmm. and then you go out and you get your certifications. Mm-hmm. There's pros and cons to both. Mm-hmm. So what we were always encouraged is that they both exist, mm-hmm. and you want to nurture both. Mm-hmm. You want to have the certs, and you want to have the knowledge of how to present information and to, particularly in this day and age, provide the legal protection for yourself and your clients. Though at the same time, that isn't much good unless you've got the actual ability to do it. And there's also guiding realm where it's like, well, I'm a guide and I take people out into the environment. Some people feel like guides should have paddled and know the place that they're going to intimately before they start guiding there. The old term of a guide would be somebody who has a skill set to take you into an environment that is unknown and keep you alive. So I tend to be of the mindset that if you are a capable guide and you have a solid skill set and you have a good education of the actual skills and how to be legally sort of protected and, and keep people protected, you should be able to take people into an environment you've never been to, but because you have an experience of that environment or environments like it, you're able to navigate them through, keep them safe, and take them to those places. So when you look at like the old explorers, they would get like a, say, an Inuit guide in the north. That Inuit guide hasn't necessarily been to that part of the Arctic before, and all these guys that are getting this guide haven't, though that Inuit skill is able to take them to that place. So I would say, yes, you want the certs, but yes, you also want to push your personal level, because the other thing too is comfort, you know, or perceived risk. Is what is the actual risk? What is your perceived risk? As a guide, you should be sitting within the comfort of your skill set and being able to take your clients to the edge of their perceived risk, where they're maybe not feeling that comfortable, but they're still safe, and you can take them there. But if you're a guide who is on the edge of their perceived risk and the clients are maybe on the edge of that perceived risk at the same time, or they're not feeling overly challenged, that's not necessarily the best position either. So guides should possess more skill set than their clientele to be able to take them to a place that the clientele want to experience on an adventure. Here's a prime example of that as a raft guide. You want to have a raft guide who can take you down a class 4 or 5 river. You don't want that raft guide to be peaking and be having the most extreme experience themselves when they're supposed to be responsible for that group. So you have to build up your skill set to be competent enough to actually deliver that product, being safe, calm, and controlled, while your clients are having this high peak experience. And sea kayaking or any other guiding can be exactly the same, right? So doesn't matter the qualifications you get, if your skill set isn't up to scale, you're never going to be able to deliver the product to the level potentially, you know. So it's, I guess it's a whole nother discussion as well, but that's a tap into it there where it's like, yes, certs are great, but you also need to push your skill level. And I think the sea kayaking world is kind of interesting because I think, like, as a mountain guide, if you get the highest level qualification in mountain guiding, you can be quite arrogant, but I also think you almost deserve it because it takes a lot to get there. Same with raft guiding aspects or ski guiding. Sea kayak guiding is kind of funny because you can, in Canada, you can become a high-level sea kayak guide and you still don't even have to be able to roll a kayak. And then some people are quite, you know, I'm going to cop a bit of flack for this in the industry, I guess, but I also like find it interesting because people are like, oh, I'm a, you know, a level 3 guide. I'm like, you know, the man, the woman, whatever. But it's like, well, you still can't necessarily roll the kayak. I'm not saying everyone can't, but you don't have to get the cert. So it's kind of an interesting realm where I think sea kayak guides often, because of the level that you provide to clients, you don't have to push it as hard. Though I still believe that sea kayak guides should be pushing their personal level higher. They should be going on solo trips to experience what it's like to camp out by yourselves, and the sound of a mouse sounds like a cougar, and you know, suddenly that small swell that you wouldn't normally think about on a beach suddenly becomes much more of a threat because you're like, ooh, there's no one actually here to help me, and so that's actually a bigger risk than I would normally perceive. Jumping in a boat and paddling for 10 hours nonstop and seeing how far you can get and experiencing what that feels like and pushing that mental and physical drive. Developing your rough water currents or developing your surf skills so that you're actually, when you're dealing with surf landings with clients, you're, again, not at a max peak and, and uncomfortable with the situation. You're actually going, yeah, well, this is manageable. And those are managing important.
This has been Outdoor Pursuits with me, Jade, and Jamie. Thanks for tuning in. Yeah, listen next time for some more shenanigans from Strathcona Park Lodge. Cheers, Jamie. That was sweet.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. Sweet as.